So how's everybody today?
Good.
Good. So this is going to be a talk that's mostly about the foundations of quantum mechanics, which is the area I study. But it's going to really focus in on one particular topic in the foundations of quantum mechanics, which is a result known as Bell's theorem. So this is one of the deepest and most mysterious results. It really underlines why we have to have a different conception of the way the world is, given quantum theory relative to the way we thought it was in previous classical theories. So we're going to try to explain to you what's so mysterious about Bell's theorem. Right, so this is, it's an old result. It's from the 60s due to an Irish physicist by the name of John Bell. But I'm going to take a particular angle on it, which is a bit more modern. And so there's a body of work in the field of, well, a few different fields, machine learning and statistics in particular. So you might have heard about how correlation does not imply causation. And that's true. We're going to talk about that. But there's a new set of tools that people have developed such that you can infer from certain facts about correlations some causal conclusions. So I'm going to take you through some of that work of how to infer facts about causal structure from correlations. And then we're going to apply some of those ideas to Bell's theorem and look at Bell's theorem through that lens near the end. So throughout the talk, please stop me at any point if there's anything unclear. And let's just get going. So let me start by just emphasizing why correlation and causation are distinct concepts. So here's a strong correlation, the rooster crowing and the sun rising. And the correlation is really about information. It's about your knowledge. So it's a symmetric relation between two variables. So here the variables are the rooster crowing or not, the sun rising or not. And if you learn that the rooster has crowed, so maybe you're in the farmhouse and the curtains are drawn and you hear the rooster crowing, you can infer from that that the sun has risen. But it's also true that if you read in your farmer's almanac that next month the sun will rise at 6 a.m., then you can infer from that that at 6 a.m. the rooster will crow. So it goes both ways. It supports inferences in both directions. It tells you if you learn the value of one variable, then you can update your information about the value of the other variable. That's what a perfect correlation does for you. But a causal relation is different. It's asymmetric. So if I, for example, make the rooster crow in the middle of the night, I'm not exactly sure how you'd do that, but maybe you squeeze the rooster do something like that. Anyways, you make the rooster crow, it does not cause the sun to rise early. But if I move the rooster eastward on the surface of the earth, then for the rooster at least, the sun is rising early, and you will find that the rooster does crow early in that case. So you can conclude that it's the sun rising that causes the rooster to crow, and not the rooster's crowing that causes the sun to rise, which we already knew, obviously. But notice that here it's a causal relation is, again, a relationship between two variables. But it's really about how controlling one variable allows you to manipulate the other. And it's a one-way relationship. Right? If I manipulate the rooster's crowing, it doesn't have any influence on the sun rising. So that's the difference between these two concepts. And it can be very difficult to disentangle them, correlation and causation. So I want to start by showing you an example of just how subtle it is to distinguish these two concepts. So it's an example from statistics known as Simpson's paradox. And here's how it works. You imagine that you have a population of people with some medical condition, and some subpopulation has taken a particular drug, and the rest have not taken the drug. And you want to know, is this drug effective for this medical condition? So what you can do is you can go to the subpopulation who took the drug and figure out what fraction of them recovered from the condition. And that's just the probability of recovery given the drug. And then you go to the population who didn't take the drug. You also calculate the fraction that recovered. And suppose you find this, that the fraction who recovered are greater among those who took the drug than among those who didn't. Well, what do you conclude? What's the natural conclusion in this case?
The drug helps with the recovery.
That seems pretty reasonable to say, yeah, well, this is, if I have this medical condition and I see this data, I might say, I probably want to take that drug. It'll help with recovery. But it's not that simple. So you decide to look at the data a little bit more carefully, and you say, what if I look at just these subpopulations for the men alone? Okay, so you consider just the collection of men, and you find the subpopulation who took the drug, calculate the number who recovered, similarly for those who didn't take the drug, and then you find the inequality goes the other way. So the number who recovered is greater among the men who didn't take the drug than among the men who took the drug. Okay, but now here's the really surprising bit. If you go to the women, you find that the inequality goes the same way as for the men. And that seems really strange, because overall, you have a higher rate of recovery among those who took the drug, even though for the men and the women individually, it's a lower rate of recovery. So this seems paradoxical, because if you just took a naive interpretation of these kinds of conditional probabilities as something like, this is telling me something about the causal influence that the drug has on recovery, and if this is greater than this, then it means the drug has a positive influence on recovery. If you read it that way, then it seems like if you're a man, you should not take the drug. If you're a woman, you should not take the drug. But if you're a member of the general population, you should take the drug. And obviously, that makes no sense at all. All right, so this is surprising. And let me try to persuade you that this can happen by showing you some actual statistical data that would look like this. So suppose that 300 men took the drug, and 180 of them recovered. So then the recovery rate for that category, the men who took the drug, can be computed to be 60%. And if you imagine that 100 men didn't take the drug and 70 of them recovered, then that's a 70% recovery rate for those who didn't take the drug. So sure enough, the recovery rate is greater for those who didn't take the drug, just as this inequality says. For the women, 100 took the drug and 20 recovered. So that's a 20% recovery rate. 300 didn't take the drug and 90 recovered. That's a 30% recovery rate. So for the women as well, it's a higher recovery rate for those who didn't take the drug. That's this inequality. But now I look at the combined statistics. So if I ask how many people total took the drug, well, there was 300 men and 100 women who took it. So that's 400 people total who took it. How many recovered? 180 plus 20 is 200. So 50% recovery rate among those who took the drug. But over here, among those who didn't, the total is again 400, but only 160 recovered. So that's a 40% recovery rate. So for the totals, the recovery rate is greater for those who took the drug. Okay, so the question here is, what's going on? How do we resolve this paradox? And furthermore, even if one can see how this isn't necessarily a contradiction or a logical paradox, it would be nice to have a resolution that would tell you what to do in this circumstance. So say you've got this data, and now you want to know, should you take this drug or not? So any good resolution of the paradox should answer the question of what you should do. So what do you think? What's going on here? Yes?
Shouldn't you give the men's and the women's population equal weight? Because right now you're just adding the sample size, right? You should put them as like multiply, just take them as fractions and then give them a weight so you don't get like
weird numbers. Okay, so what weights would you recommend giving them?
0.5 for men and then 0.5 for women.
So you're just saying average of these two numbers?
Yeah.
Now, okay, so if you did that, average of these two numbers, an average of these two numbers, I'm not sure you would necessarily resolve the paradox. But even if you could, there's an argument to be made that the correct weighting would be 3/4, 1/4, because there were three times as many men in the population who took the drug, right? So I have 300 men who took the drug, 100 women who took the drug. So what I've done here is essentially what you're describing, but with a weighting of 3/4 and 1/4. And you could argue that that's appropriate given the numbers who took the drug and were men and women. Yes?
Well, there's another effect that we have to take into account is that being male correlates to taking the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And being male also correlates to a higher recovery probability.
Right, yes, good.
So from this reasoning, taking the drug, being male okay, I'm not sure if it goes both ways, but this is an effect that just by the fact that more males take the drug, and males have a higher chance to recover, so the people who take the drug have a higher chance to recover, and the drug is not necessarily effective.
Very good. Yes. That's right. Well, that's, I think, ultimately what's going on here, how to resolve the paradox is to recognize that correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation. And so let's go through that. First, I'll start by saying why it appears like a paradox. So I think why it appears to a paradox to us, appears like a paradox to us, is because intuitively we think of this kind of causal structure as what's going on. So certainly we have this impression that the treatment has a causal influence on recovery, either positive or negative, but it does something. It influences your chances of recovery. And secondly, gender could influence recovery because maybe for this medical condition, men and women just recover naturally at different rates, regardless of whether they've taken the drug or not. And you know, when you look at the data, you've got a significant difference in recovery rates among the men and the women. So it's sort of reasonable to think that this is that kind of medical condition. So if you think that this is what's going on, you really can't have the sort of reversal that we see here, right? These sorts of statistics will never arise if this is what's happening in nature. And the reason is, if this is what's happening, then to compute the overall probability of recovery given treatment, I just average the probability of recovery given treatment for the two genders. If I wanted to compute this by averaging these two quantities, and compute this by averaging these two quantities, so I'm just weighting them by the probability of being a man and by the probability of being a woman, then clearly those weighted average would have the same inequality here. So I would get the opposite of this. I would never see this reversal. So this really can't explain the statistics we've seen. And the resolution is that actually this is the causal structure that describes the experiment we did. So it's the case that gender not only had a causal influence on recovery, but it had a causal influence on what treatment was taken. Whether people got administered the drug or not was not what was influenced by their gender. So you'll probably have noticed that there's this big difference in the number of men who took and didn't take the drug and the number of women, and it's a reversal. So the men were more likely to take the drug than the women were. I should say that the men were three times more likely to take the drug than not take the drug, and for the women it was the opposite. They were three times more likely to not take the drug than to take the drug. So there's this strong causal influence from gender to treatment. And so now the point is this, that there's a common cause between treatment and recovery. And so if you remember that a correlation is really a fact about your information, you can read the top line here as follows. You can understand the fact that taking the drug and recovering are positively correlated in the following way. You can say, well, for this particular illness, men are more likely to recover than women are, regardless of whether they take the drug. And it so happens that men are more likely to take the drug than women are. And so if I just give you a member of the population and I tell you this fact about them, they took the drug, do you think that they are likely to have recovered or not? Then you can reason as follows. Well, if they took the drug, they're more likely to have been a man. And if they're a man, they're more likely to have recovered. So based on the information that this person take the drug, I will infer that they're more likely to have recovered. But that doesn't mean that taking the drug causes recovery. You're just making an inference from taking the drug to recovery by virtue of this common cause of the two, not by virtue of this causal influence. And if I just look at the subcategory of men, for example, then it can't generate correlations between recovery and treatment. I'm fixing this variable now. And so then it's all causal influence. And the fact that they're now negatively correlated tells me that the treatment is not good for recovery. So the point is that you really need to think carefully about the causal structure if you want to interpret conditional probabilities in a causal way. And so for this particular drug trial, it is better to not take the drug than to take it, because this correlation that we saw was just spurious. It was due to this common cause of gender. Good. So questions about that? Yes?
Wait, so when they do the drug test, are they really allowed to do this? Because shouldn't they take do equal-sized samples?
Good, yeah. So if you just let people choose to take a drug or not, you can get these kinds of phenomena, and then it becomes difficult to interpret your data. You definitely wouldn't want to go to your data and naively just calculate this to determine whether it's effective. You could try to interpret it in a more sophisticated way. But you're right that if you have total control over the design of the drug trial, you might say, well, we have to work very hard to make sure there is no error here. And so that's why people use randomized trials. They say, regardless of the preferences of any patient, we're going to administer drug or placebo based on a coin flip. And we're confident that the outcome of the coin flip has nothing to do with your gender or anything else. And therefore, we can eliminate that arrow. And then when we see this positive correlation between treatment and recovery, we know it's causal and not due to some common cause. That's right. Okay, and now let me mention that, I mean, the reason people develop algorithms for trying to figure out just based on observational data. So we often call the kinds of data we're talking about here observational, where you haven't done a randomized trial, okay, as opposed to what statisticians called experimental or interventional data, where you know certain bits you've come in and randomized. The reason people are interested in tools for getting causal conclusions from this sort of data is that you can't always do the randomized trial. So first of all, randomized trials are extremely expensive to do. Secondly, they're often unethical. Like if I want to know, does smoking cause lung cancer? I don't do a randomized trial and assign a bunch of would-be non-smokers, you know, I make them smoke, especially if I think that it does cause lung cancer. So there's just no possibility for doing that experiment. But then there's also cases like in astrophysics where we might have various variables that we're observing and we're seeing statistical correlations, but we just have no capability of going in and manipulating any of those variables because we're just observing. So for all those reasons, there's a need for tools to just analyze observational data and try to extract any causal conclusions we can from it. Good. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about the formalism that people have developed more generally for extracting such causal information. So I want to define for you the notion of a causal model. So it consists of two parts, a causal structure and some causal statistical parameter. So what's the causal structure? It's technically a directed acyclic graph. So it's a graph like this one. The nodes of the graph are variables. So these are like our gender variable, treatment variable, recovery variable, stuff like that. The directed edges of the graph are interpreted as this variable has a direct causal influence on this one. There are also indirect causal influences, like T has a direct causal influence on X, but it also has an indirect causal influence via Y, for instance. Those notions are distinguished here. And the parameters are probability distributions and conditional probability distributions. So if I take a variable like Y, I'm supposed to specify the for every value of Y, what's the probability of Y taking that value given that its parents, so let's see which ones have arrows into Y, W and T. So given every possible value of Y's parents, what's the probability of every value of Y? That's what this conditional probability says. It's really a list of numbers. For every choice of values of these two guys, what's the probability of this taking any of its values? So I do that for every variable. So here, Y has parents W and T. X actually has all the other guys as parents. You'll see there's arrows into X from everywhere else. So I have to tell you the conditional of X given all of the others. And then some of them, like W, S, and T, have no parents in the graph. And so I just specify a distribution, so the probability for all the different values of each of those variables. Yes?
For like nodes that both have like both an in and out degree, like non-zero degree, like how does that work? Like can you give us like an example?
For example, in the case of smoking and lung cancer, you could have the following causal hypothesis. You could say smoking causes people to have tar in their lungs, and having tar in your lungs causes lung cancer. So that'd be a case where the tar in the lungs would be a mediary between smoking and lung cancer.
But like it could also like come from outside smoking, right? So that's why it's an independent node. Otherwise, it just directly, smoking goes directly.
Oh, you mean like what's a situation where I might have many things influencing one thing?
Yeah.
Well, like take a firing squad.
Okay.
each soldier either fires or not,
okay.
and the prisoner either dies or not. Everyone, any one of the soldiers firing is sufficient to cause the prisoners to die. So they're all causes,
right?
So you could have, you know, for N soldiers, you'd have N nodes and then one effect of all of them.
Okay.
Good. So it's not too hard to show that if you ask for this kind of causal model, so these sorts of causal connections between variables, these conditional probabilities tell me something about the strengths of those causal connections. So when I tell you what the probability of the different values of y given w and t are, I'm telling you something about how strongly w and t influence or determine y. So it could be, for example, a very strong influence where y is completely determined by the values in wt, or maybe y is, you know, just mostly random and the probabilities of its different values are just a little bit influenced by the values of W and T. So those sorts of things will be captured in these conditional probabilities. And if you want to know what do I expect to see as the joint probability of all these variables taking on any particular set of values, I can compute that as just the product of these conditionals. So that's like a generalization of the fact that if I tell you that A causes B, here's the probabilities for A being 0 or 1, here are the conditional probabilities for B being 0 or 1 for each value of A. What are the total probabilities for A and B taking values 0, 0, or 0, 1, or 1, 0, or 1, 1? It's just the product. You compute the probability of B given A times the probability of A. That'll give you the probability of A and B. So this is how you compute what you expect to see in your observations. If you just go and measure all these variables, many times over, so it's a statistical trial, you'll expect the relative frequency of the different values of those variables to be given by this kind of expression. Okay, so that's how you define statistics from a causal model, but these causal inference algorithms, so the problem of inferring causal relations from statistical data, they're trying to solve the inverse problem. So there, you're given some joint distribution, and what you want to know is what sorts of causal explanations could have given rise to it. So what sorts of directed acyclic graphs and parameters might explain the distribution we've seen? So that's the basic problem that there's been a lot of work on in recent years in machine learning. And I'm not going to take you into many details of these algorithms, but I'm going to just point out two principles that go into defining these algorithms. Because they're all we're really going to need to talk about Bell's theorem. Okay, so the first principle is that when you do see statistical dependences between variables, they need to be explained causally, that there aren't just raw statistical dependences without causal explanation. So in fact, this principle has already appeared in the formalism that I've described, because I said, for instance, that if W and S, for example, which have no parents, if I look at this joint distribution, W and S are they each have their own distribution. So there is no correlations between W and S in this distribution. So there's just some distribution for W, some distribution for S. It's like two coin flips. They're independent. And you might have asked, well, why shouldn't you allow some correlations between them? Like maybe W and S always take the same values. Why don't you allow that distribution to be consistent with this causal structure? And the answer is, if you want things to be correlated, then you have to encode it causally. So you have to say, for example, that either W influences S, or maybe there's a common cause of W and S, or maybe there's an influence from S to W. But if none of those things are there, if W and S, as here, are both just root variables in this tag, then they're necessarily uncorrelated, right? So another way to read this principle is that if things are causally disconnected, then they're statistically independent, right? That's the logically the same as saying things that are statistically dependent, those dependencies need to be explained causally. In that case, they're causally connected in some way. So that's a pretty natural principle. Yes?
Can your causal model be cyclic?
Well, the reason we exclude cycles. So this is an A, you're right, I didn't say that explicitly. This is an acyclic graph, meaning there should be no closed loops. And the reason we do that is we don't think causes operate that way. So to imagine a causal loop is to imagine something like a time travel, right? Where and that leads to logical paradoxes, like the famous grandfather paradox. You go back in time with your time machine, you kill your grandfather, your parents are never born, so how was it that you were able to kill your grandfather because you were never born? You know, so those are logical paradoxes. And so excluding causal loops are intended to, well, first of all, to represent what we believe is true about causation and to avoid those kinds of logical contradictions. Now, of course, I mean, you could perhaps try to come up with a more exotic notion of causation that included those things. It's just not what we're doing today. Or this is sort of the plain vanilla notion of causation with no causal loops or paradoxes. Okay, so that's the first principle. And then there's just one more principle I need. And to explain it, I'm going to give you your first chance to do a little bit of causal inference. So here it is. So suppose you've got three variables, A, B, and C, and you've done some observations of them over many trials. You've computed the relative frequency with which A, B, and C take on various values, like maybe 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on. And you've summarized all those relative frequencies in this joint probability distribution. It's just a list of those relative frequencies. And you notice that A is independent of B, meaning that if you sum over all the possible values that C can take, which allows you to compute just the joint probabilities for A and B taking their values, then it factorizes. So A and B look like, you know, independent coin flips when you ignore C. And suppose you notice that there are no other independences. So A is correlated with C, B is correlated with C. And furthermore, if I condition on C, if I look at a particular value of C, then A and B are correlated. So they're only uncorrelated when I ignore the value of C. So this is what you've observed. And then you ask yourself, what could have given rise to this kind of correlations? So let's assume that A, B, and C are the only causally relevant variables. What sorts of arrows between A, B, and C could give rise to this? So
connecting A and C and B and C.
All right, so connecting A and C and B and C. So what direction do the arrowheads go in?
They point to C.
They point to C. Okay. Good. Any other suggestions?
Just B connecting to C, or just A connecting to C and B isolated.
So what's the suggestion?
A connects to C or B connects to C, but the other one doesn't have an influence on C. So it's like one.
Oh, I see. Like one or the other, but not both. So if you mean consider, yeah. So these would be the other two here. So if I look at these guys individually, they won't be able to explain what we've seen, simply because if C and B are not connected at all, I expect them to be independent. But over here we said B and C are dependent, right? There were no other independence relations, so that B and C were correlated in this distribution. And therefore, this sort of model can't work. And similarly, A and C are correlated in the distribution, so this sort of model by itself can't work. And if I have both these things going on, then really I'm talking about this sort of model. So this is, in fact, a great explanation of what we've seen, because in this kind of model, A and B are indeed independent, right? So they both have no parents. So what we saw from the first principle was that they shouldn't be correlated. But A and C should be correlated because A causes C, and B and C should be correlated because B causes C. And furthermore, if I look at a particular value of C, it turns out I can make A and B correlated. So that's a little bit subtle, but if you think about like the firing, or let me see, what's a good example? Like if I have a bell that only rings if two coin flips are both heads, right? Then when it does not ring, for example, if I say condition on it not ringing, I learn that A and B were either both tails or tails and heads or heads and tails. And the point is that now they're correlated, right? They're not independent coin flips anymore. I know it's one of those three possibilities. So generically, when you have this structure, you condition on this, you induce correlations. And that's what we had over on the left-hand side. Yes?
So could you also reverse the causality, so C to A and C to B?
Good question. Let me draw it over here.
No.
So what do people think? Is this, would this work?
Doesn't it only work like in restricted cases?
I'm sorry?
It only works like in restricted cases. Like for example, I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't think it works.
Okay, edit somebody.
Then they're dependent on C now, and so they're not. There are arrows pointing to them. So now, there you flip that independence relation. So now C is the independent one.
What would C be independent of here?
So now A and B are causes of C. So now
what?
Sorry. It's,
Here we're measuring the arrows go this way.
Yeah.
So C is a cause of A and it's a cause of B.
Yeah, so C now is the independent one, so it doesn't satisfy the A is in B.
It depends on what A, B, and C is.
Anyone else have an idea?
Well, doesn't that mean C causes A and B?
Mm-hmm.
So that A and B are not independent because something causes them and there's a relationship.
Right. So typically when we have common causes, so C is a common cause of A and B, this is exactly like gender being a cause of both recovery and treatment. And in those sorts of circumstances, you expect these things can be correlated. Right? So like, for example, if I flip a coin and then I have two other coins, which I set to be equal to that, whatever I got here, then, you know, when this is heads, they're both heads. And when this is tail, they're both tails. So if I look at the joint distribution of these guys, I find that with probability half, they're both heads. With probability half, they're both tails. It's a strong correlation. So that's what I expect generically whenever I have common causes. I expect correlations. But here we said that A and B, when I ignore C, should be uncorrelated. And so that's inconsistent with this. Yes?
Are there any situations where neither A or B would correlate when they're both caused by C?
When they would not be correlated, even though they were both caused with C? Well, the only circumstance would be if C, let's say it's this coin flip, if it was completely biased towards just being one thing, like if C was always heads, never tails, then there's no variation in the value of C, and so A and B will just each take on some particular value, and I don't have any correlation between them. But typically, we presume that these probability distributions are not point distributions. They don't have all their weight on one value. And in those circumstances, whenever I see a pattern like this, I expect A and B to be correlated. Yes?
Could it be possible to have like a two-way correlation? I mean,
a two-way arrow, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, this would be, again, one of those cycles, right? So this would be like your grandfather paradox, where A causes C and C causes A. So that could be a contradiction. So no, we don't allow those cycles. That's part of saying it's a acyclic graph, directed and acyclic. Yes?
So those kinds of causal structures where C influences A and A influences C exist in some, like maybe in a biology context where you have positive reinforcement where increasing one thing, like you could have something that causes C, C causes A,
right.
A causes the release of a hormone causes, I don't know, this thing to happen and that thing happening causes the hormone to release more or something?
You could. And then the way you would analyze that in this formalism is you would say we must distinguish the values of these variables at different moments in time. So you could have, for example, A causes C, and then at the next moment in time, C has an influence back on A. But you know, there's no grandfather paradoxes here because I have no arrows that are going back in time. So I could have arrows in both directions, you know, from A to C and from C to A. But when I unfold it over time, I realize that there's still no cycles. All right. So that's the kind of thing we have in mind here. Okay. So this guy won't work because it implies that A and B would be dependent. Contrary to what we saw. But this guy works nicely. It gives us exactly what we've seen. A and B are independent. And in fact, you can show that no matter what probability distribution you choose for A and for B and for the conditional probability of C given A and B here, when you compute the joint distribution over A, B, and C, it has exactly this independence relation. So that's nice. It's a good explanation. So the second principle I'm telling you about relates to the fact that this is actually not the only logically possible explanation. There are others. So here's one. So I could have C influencing A and B, like what we had here, but also B influences A directly, like this arrow says. And generically, you would expect A and B, if for this kind of causal structure, you generically expect A and B to be correlated, to violate this, because there's multiple ways they could be correlated. B has a direct influence on A. There's also a common cause affecting the two. But it turns out that if you choose the parameters in this model extremely carefully, you can make it so that A and B are uncorrelated. So intuitively, you might think, for example, the direct causal influence sets up a positive correlation, the common cause sets up a negative correlation, and they exactly cancel. So what that means in this language is that for very particular choices of the parameters in this model, you can get a joint distribution that satisfies this. But if I vary those parameters even a little bit, it will no longer satisfy this independence relation. So this sort of model is fine-tuned. It only works to explain what we've seen for very explicit choices of these parameters and for no other choices. Okay, so that's in these algorithms, this is considered a bad causal explanation because it's not robust to any variation in the parameters. So is that clear intuitively why it's a bad explanation? I think one of the examples that was given to explain this is that if you see a chair and you're asked how many chairs are there, you know, the natural answer is to say one, but if it's logically possible that from your perspective, there could be a second chair behind it, and the first chair is exactly blocking the second chair from your view, that's another explanation. You could say, well, it's possible that there are two chairs. But that conclusion would hold only for that one perspective, and for every other perspective you might take, it would be false. So that's the idea here. Like this kind of consistency is only true for these very particular choices of parameters. So it seems like an unlikely explanation. Good. Okay, so that's it. Those are the two principles we need. The second principle I'm just going to refer to as these fine-tuned causal explanations are bad explanations. So we don't want to allow those kinds of explanations. Okay, so now we move on to the connection with physics. So here's the kind of experiment we're going to apply these causal inference tools to. So the setup is you have a device that prepares two particles. Okay. And then those two particles are sent off to two locations, and each one is subjected to a measurement. All right, so you're going to hear a bit about how in quantum theory there are incompatible measurements. So if you try to measure the position of a particle, you can't simultaneously measure its momentum. So you have to choose to measure either position or momentum. You can't measure both at the same time. And similarly, particles that have a property called spin, you can measure their spin in the z-axis or in the x-axis direction, but you can't measure those two properties simultaneously. So there's a whole bunch of examples of incompatibility. And what we're going to imagine here is, in the quantum experiment, x is a variable that ranges over different possible measurements that are incompatible. So there's a little dial here which just sets your measurement device to measure position or momentum, to measure x spin or z spin, for instance. You can't measure them both, so you have to make a choice. And then there's a couple of little LED lights on the device that just register an outcome. So in the case of spin, you can only be up spin or down spin. So if it's up, you might get the green LED, and if it's down, you get the red LED coming on. And this A variable is just going to track what the outcome was. We'll call it 0 or 1. And it's the same thing over here on the right-hand side. And now, what's important is that it really doesn't matter what these properties are, right? So whether it's spin or position or momentum, or that's kind of irrelevant to the whole argument. So we're just going to go abstractly and say, look, there's a choice of two possible measurements over here, each of which have an outcome labeled by A. There's a possible choice of two measurements here, each of which have a binary outcome, and that's it. And it turns out that quantum theory predicts that there are, you know, ways of setting this up such that this is the kind of statistical data you get. So over here, the rows just describe the possible settings of the two devices. So remember, these x and y's are just one of two choices on each side. So I'll call those choices 0 and 1. So x and y can be both 0, or they could be 0 and 1, or 1 and 0, or 1 and 1. Those are the four possible experiments that you can do. And for each one, there are only four possible outcomes. So both A and B, both sides could report outcome 0, or the left could be 0 and the right could be 1, or 1 and 0, or 1 and 1. Right? So those are the four columns. And then these numbers just tell me the relative probability. So if this is the experiment I'm doing where they're both 0, then this says that with almost 50% probability, they're both 0 or both 1. And with close to 0 probability, they're 0, 1, or 1, 0. And similarly for the rest of the table. So I'm not going to show you how this works, but there are choices of quantum preparations and measurements that give you exactly this data. Okay, so you just have to take my word for that. And then the question becomes, what kinds of causal explanations of this data are possible? So what kind of directed acyclic graph among A, B, X, and Y could possibly explain what we've seen here? Now, one thing I didn't mention is that among causal explanations, you often want to allow there to be variables that you haven't observed. So, you know, in the case of lung cancer and smoking, there might be this variable that you hadn't observed directly, like tar in the lungs, which is important to the causal analysis. And so similarly here, if you ask what's the most natural causal explanation for what we see, it involves an extra variable that you haven't observed directly, which would correspond to something like the specification of the common causes of the properties of these two particles. Right? So lambda could be something about the mechanism that prepares these two particles. So the idea here is that the measurement on the left responds to the properties of this left particle. The measurement on the right responds to the properties of the right particle. And those properties can be correlated because they started from a common origin, so that there was some variable that was randomly distributed. And the properties of these two particles depended on the value of that variable. So there's correlations between them. And it's those correlations that then set up correlations between the outcomes of these two measurements. That's the idea of the natural causal explanation. And it's particularly natural given that, you know, these two settings could be very far away from one another, such that it doesn't look like there's any causal influences directly between them. Okay. So that's really the question that Bell's theorem seeks to address, is can this be a causal explanation of this experiment? So that's what we're going to do next. So here's John Bell. And the setup is going to be pretty much similar to what we've seen before. Here's our red and green LED lights indicating binary outcomes. I'm going to change things a little bit. So instead of that knob, I'm just going to have H and T as labels of the boxes telling you what kind of measurement you did. So there's just these two kinds of measurements, an H measurement or a T measurement. And so I'm going to imagine an experiment that looks like this, where either you're measuring H on both sides, or H and T, or T and H, or T and T. That's it. Those are the four setups we have. And they're going to be determined by a coin flip, right? So heads or tails, and that's where H and T come from. Just which measurement you do depends on the outcome of a coin flip on each side. Okay, so I think that's all I need for the setup. And now to demonstrate how this works, we're gonna act out what these particles would have to do. And so for that, I'm gonna need some volunteers. So can I have two volunteers? And to motivate you to volunteer, there will be cash prizes if you can solve the puzzles that I've set up. One at the back, and how about you here at the front? Thank you. And I'm also going to need two helpers. But maybe if we could have the chaperones or... can you guys help me out? All right. So if you guys come stand in the middle, I'll explain in a minute what you're supposed to do. Let me give you this. I'll give you this. So the setup is this. So the two of you are the two particles. You start out together in the middle, and you know what's going to happen, that there's going to be, you're going to be subjected to measurements on either side of the room. So at some point, you're going to go off, and you're going to be subjected to measurements, and you're going to have to report an outcome. Okay. So the way that's going to work is that these guys are going to have coins to flip. They're going to flip the coin. That's going to be like the choice of what measurement they're doing. And then they're going to write down the outcome of the coin flip on the paper I've given them. And then you are going to see that. They're going to show you the paper. You're going to see what measurement's being done on you. And then you're going to have to write down R or G, red or green, as your outcome. Okay? So that's sort of how we're mimicking the measurements, right? That's what's ultimately going to happen is that you're going to read H or T after the coin flip, and you're going to write down red or green. But now, and at the end of the game, I'm going to take those two cards together, and I'm going to see the kinds of correlations you've generated, so whether you, you know, wrote down the same outcome or not. And there's going to be a particular rule, and if you respect that rule, you'll win the game. So here's the rule. So maybe turn around and take a look. So you know the basic setup. There's these two possible measurements, the two outcomes. And if it happens that the same measurement is made on you, then at the end you win if your outcomes agree. Right? So if it just so happens that these guys both get heads or both get tails, and they write down HH or TT on their cards, and then you give your answers and we get them together and your answers are the same, then you'll win. Okay? If your answers are different in that circumstance, you'll lose. When different measurements are made on you, then your outcomes should disagree. So in those cases, you should have reported opposite outcomes. So is it clear what's going to happen?
Yes.
How about you? Is it clear? No. So what's unclear? So is it clear what the protocol is going to be? Like, at some point, that's clear.
Yeah. Okay.
So the trick now is that before we start the game, you two guys are going to confer, and you have to make a plan. So the plan could be something like, look, if I get H, I'm going to write down red. But if you do get H, then you should, you know, write down green. Or, you know, whatever. Like, well, what if you see T, you know, what are we going to do? That's kind of what your plan has to be. And the key thing is that once you've gone off and the coins are flipped, you're not going to learn what the other person's outcome was. Okay, so we're going to be watching you, and so there's going to be no, you know, funny business where you signal across the room and tell your partner what you got, right? And that's also why we're writing these things down, because I don't want anybody speaking out loud what the outcome was so that the person on the other side will not hear it. So it's all going to be written down carefully so the other person can't see. And so it's really important that you have a good plan. Because once we start and you go off and the coins are flipped, you have no idea what happened on the other end, okay? So you need to be prepared for all eventualities. Is it clear now?
Yeah.
Okay, so what we're going to do is everybody else, I want you to also think about how you would try to win this game. So you can get together in groups if you want, but I'm going to give you guys a couple of minutes to think this through, come up with a strategy for the game.
There's a way.
Oh, and if you get it right, you win the coin. That's, I should have said that.
Oh.
If you get You're all set? Okay, so collect your cards and your coins. Good, so go off to your separate stations. And on my signal, we'll have the coin flips. Go ahead, flip the coins. All right, and now write down on the paper what the outcome of the coin flip was. All right, and then hand the paper and the pen over to the particle. And the particle can respond by writing down red or green. go. Okay. Drum roll, please. Let's see if we... So over on the right, it was heads, and the answer was red. And on the left, it was heads, and the answer was red.
Yay.
Which satisfies the rules, so well done. You can collect your cash prize and sit down. Thanks for your help. And the, oh, that's your prize. Don't forget your prize money.
Is it 25 cents or $1?
It's actually a whole Canadian dollar. So, okay, but one last thing for you to do. Explain to me what your strategy was.
Okay, so should I explain?
Yeah.
So, we said I have a problem writing, and if it's H means red, and D means green.
Tail is green.
Yeah, so if I got H, I should have, I had to put my card up and write red. If it is green, I shall write it like this way.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that way we figured out what the other person is doing.
Oh, okay. That's
that's cheating.
Yeah. Technically. Yes, technically that's called subverting the rules of the game that I tried to implement. And we were watching you, and we just didn't even notice that that was happening. All right, well, let me, can anyone tell me how you might do this without signaling?
Heads is red, tails is green.
Sorry, heads is red and tails is green.
Yeah,
then you get heads, you always have different colors.
Even if I did not see it, but if both of us got heads, then we'd both end up writing red.
I see, so that was like just a backup strategy.
Yeah, just like
okay, good, good. All right, so... That's right. So let's let me just illustrate that. So this is kind of the challenge. Like, if I just think these two pictures just mean the different things that could have happened on the right. So it could have been that tails came up on the right. It could have been that heads came up on the right. So there's still just one measurement. These are just the two possibilities. Similarly over here, and these four lines just correspond to the four possibilities that could have occurred, right? And they're each occurring with equal likelihood. So with probably a quarter, one of these four pairs is going to occur. And the rules of the game were that if it's the pair H and H, then your outcomes should agree. If it's the pair tail and tails, your outcomes should agree. But if it's the pair H and T or T and H, then they should disagree. And so if you imagined a strategy where you report one color for heads and the other color for tails and the same choice on the other side, then it satisfies everything because it's green and green here, red and red here, but different colors across those diagonals. Okay, so that's essentially the strategy. Okay, so now I'm going to give you another game. So there's we're not going to act this one out, but I'm also going to give you a couple of minutes to think about it. There's a $1 prize for anyone who can win this game. So the rules are the same, except now when it's the same measurement that's made on A and B, then the outcomes should disagree. Whereas when it's different measurements that are made on A and B, then the outcomes should agree. So I want to give everybody just, even if some of you already see how to do this, just everybody think about this for a minute or so. And then I'll take suggestions. And I'll remember that there's some people who already see how to do it. Okay, so I saw some hands go up very early on, so I think you were first, so I'll take you, yeah.
Like just one person, let's say the first person, if it's H, he goes red. If it's T, he goes green.
Okay.
The other person does the exact opposite. So if it's H, he does green.
Yeah, exactly. So in this case, so all that's changed is that now they should disagree in the H, H, and T cases and agree in the other two cases. So if I just reverse the colors on the right relative to the left, I get exactly the right pattern. I get disagreements here and here and agreements here and here. So yes. Very good. So you guys know how to play these games. So now I'm going to give you another one. This one's a little bit more challenging. So I'll give you a little bit more time. But maybe because it's so challenging, this is a $2 prize for those who can get it right. So same setup as before. But now if the measurement T is made on both sides, then the outcomes should disagree. So that's the case when they're both T. In all other cases, so when they're H and H, or H and T, or T and H, then the outcomes should always agree. So take a couple of minutes to think about this one. Well, I'll take hands after a little bit. I just want to make sure people had a chance to think it through. Does anyone have a suggestion for how to win it?
I did not consider one scenario.
Ah, I see. All right, go ahead.
Well, it requires that one of the separate measuring equipment has like same color for two different letters. So you'd have one of them for say have T red and the other T green.
Hang on. So let me just write this down. Can people see this board in the low light? On the left, you said T should be red?
Red and H green.
And H green, okay.
And in the other one, T green and H green.
So this is the strategy that you... Sorry, no, you continue. You're saying something about...
T and H disagree.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, wait. Did somebody want to say why this is not a good strategy?
Yeah,
yes, because in the last one, when T and H both are supposed to agree, what ends up happening is they disagree.
Right. Okay, so this strategy does not work.
Yeah.
Any other suggestions? Yes?
Okay, if they were tuned the other way around, so if T was red and H was green, and then the other one...
T red here, and H green on this side?
Okay. They disagree in one scenario.
Yeah.
Same thing about red.
No, the other way around.
Here.
Not sure, but I'm not there yet, but I think it can be shown that it's impossible.
Okay, in that case... You have to prove it to me that it's impossible.
Yeah.
So, okay, good.
Wait, couldn't you try just every single case for the...
Yeah, no, but it is.
And then, like, if not a single case works, then...
You're right that there are only 16 possible strategies because there's two possible colors here.
Well, some cases you don't have to consider because you just swap the colors.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, can that be... turned into a proof that it can't be done?
You could probably just list out all the possibilities.
Uh-huh.
And then you would arrive that, and then you would come to the conclusion that one scenario does not fit into the specified, all the possible combinations.
Okay, but I need to see a proof.
suppose?
Yes, sorry, somebody back here.
H and H have to be the same.
H and H have to be the same, okay.
T's have to be the same as one H, so literally all four have to be the same.
Okay. So you're saying that because H and T have to be the same, then these guys all have to be the same.
So T and T would be the same, but they have to disagree.
Good. Yes. So that is a proof. So let me just go over that again. So no matter what you chose, for example, let's say you start here and you say it's going to be green. Then the fact that these have to be the same tells you this has to be green. The fact that these have to be the same tells you this has to be green. The fact that these have to be the same tells you this has to be green. But now these are both green, and they were supposed to be different. And they would have been the same thing if I'd started with red here. I would have concluded that they're all red, and I would have violated the rule. So that's indeed a proof that it can't be done.
Wait, if you turn it into a graph like 2SAT, then you can find a cycle, right? So which means it can't.
Sorry, hang on, let me. There you go. Sorry, again?
If you turn it into a 2SAT graph.
What is a 2SAT graph?
Satisfiability. Like for example, if T implies the other T, right? So like if T is true, then it implies the other T
right.
false, right?
Right.
If the first H is true, implies the
right.
other H is true. If the first H is false, implies the other H is false.
Yep.
You can find a cycle, which means it. You can find, if T is true, it also implies the first T is false.
Right.
It means the graph cannot be.
Yes, that is another way you could think about it. So here's maybe just a little bit more visible version of what we just saw. Here's what the definition of the game, so the outcomes should disagree when they're both T. No matter where I start, no matter what color, I can just use these things to figure out that it all has to be colored the same way, and then I don't satisfy this criterion here. Okay, so question. If we played this game many, many times, suppose we came up here, we played this game with these rules, all right? So we ran it over and over again. So we know that there's no strategy that the players could use to always win. But what fraction of the time, what's the maximum fraction of the time they could win?
75%.
Yes. And why is that?
Because if you just say that you always put, there is a 1 in 4 chance that it gets T and T. But if you just say it's always put green, you will get 75%, but that's the
right. Max. And if you look at any other choice of colors, right? So we talked about there's 16 possibilities for what all the answers could be. For any choice of those colors, at most you're going to win 3/4 of the time. So not just for this strategy, but every other strategy, there's always one choice of settings where you're going to lose. So you can always make your winning strategy 75%. So if we play the game, we'd expect them to win at most 75% of the time. So now here's the really strange thing. If we do this experiment with quantum particles, and we set it off, and we do the measurements, and we ask, how well do they do in this game? With what frequency do they win this game? The answer is 85% of the time. So, question. How do the quantum particles do it?
They cheated.
Very good. So
they can talk to each other.
Yeah. So yeah, how did they cheat? What are the ways they could have cheated? Ah, well, let's instead of talking about the quantum particles, let's imagine that the quantum particles are just like what we saw up here. Just, you know, they have a strategy. If we did the experiment here with people, what are the cheating strategies they could have used to win this last game? We didn't do this last game up on the stage, but suppose we had. And I suppose we did it many times, and we saw that the players were winning with greater than 75%. What kinds of cheating strategies would we conclude?
Probably.
Yeah, like so the cheating strategy you were using, where the card flip was like a signal of what outcome you got, would be an example that would allow you to win this game. So for instance, in this particular game here, you could say, for example, that over on the left, when the person gets T on the left, then they get a message from the person on the right as to whether they got H or T, and then they make their outcome depend on that as well. So when it's T on the right, they report red, and when it's H on the right, they report green. Then they'll satisfy this, right? So if their outcome here can depend not just on their local setting, but on knowledge of what the distance setting was through that signal, then they can win the game 100% of the time. Are there other cheating strategies they could use? Well, I'm just talking about, this very, like right here, today, what could they have done to win this game? No quantum weirdness for now. Yes?
If they had like some sort of influence on the outcome of the coin flip.
Good. So maybe, for example, if they were in cahoots with the coin flippers and they had an agreement that the coin flip should not come out random, but it should definitely be heads, for example. If they had some guarantee like that, then they could also win this game. Okay, so let's go through those. The possibilities are you could rig the game so that the choice of settings aren't random, but are actually correlated with the strategies that the players are using. Or you could try to communicate the choice of measurement at one wing to the system that's at the opposite wing. Right, so this would allow you to explain something like an 85% probability, well, anything above 75%. But now suppose you do the experiment this way. Suppose you make sure that the particles are separated off to different points in space, very, very far away, and then the measurement on each side is chosen at random, and the outcome is registered very shortly after. So you really randomize the measurement, so you don't let it be fixed by some process like the whim of somebody who you could cooperate with, but rather, you know, some random process fixes the outcome of the measurement. Fixes the choice of the measurement. And then the outcome is registered shortly thereafter. Similarly over here, and you set it up in such a way that even if a light signal departs from the left wing right after the measurement is chosen and heads off to the right wing, it doesn't get there in time, right? So this, I've drawn here a space-time diagram. Time goes up, space goes to the right. This is the light cone. So it just says that light can only influences this part of space at these later times. But the outcome over here has to be returned at an earlier time. So the outcome doesn't have the benefit of knowing what the measurement is here is because the signal hasn't gotten it to it in time. So if you did the experiment that way, you know, you've made your choices of measurements, you know, truly random to the best of your capability. So you don't think that there could be any correlations between these measurement choices and the strategies the particles are using. And you make it so that the theory of relativity tells you that the particle over on the left can't possibly get a signal about which setting was chosen on the right because light doesn't have time to reach it. Then what would you expect that we would see in terms of the probabilities? You'd expect 75% because you've sort of eliminated all the cheating strategies. So the surprise is that you do this, you know, we do this in the lab exactly with these kinds of constraints, and we still see 85%. So that's the mystery. How do these particles manage to beat that 75% bound? That's the Bell inequality. It says your probability of success should be no higher than 75%. How do they beat it in these sorts of setups? So now, very quickly, let's return to our sort of causal analysis from the early part of the talk. This, remember, was the causal hypothesis we thought was most natural for this experiment. But it's exactly what we've just ruled out, right? This is the strategy where the players, you know, have some correlations between their plans, and they go off and they try to enforce the correlations based on their common strategy. That's exactly what Bell's theorem rules out. It says that sort of explanation is not possible. So this kind of statistics is exactly the third game I told you about. So if you look at it, it says whenever the two settings, you know, in my case, they were both tails, so here tails corresponds to value 1. Whenever they're both value 1, then the outcomes should be anti-correlated, so 0, 1, or 1, 0. So I put a probability half for those two guys. And in all other cases, they should be correlated, either both 0 or both 1. So this is a statistical data table that corresponds to the rules of the third game. And we show that that couldn't be explained with this kind of causal structure. And furthermore, even if I bring those probabilities down from a half, so if I look at these two numbers, I sum them, that's 85%. That's the 85% I've been talking about. So here, when x and y are both 1, I have 85% chance that they're outcomes disagree, and in all of the cases, I have an 85% chance that the outcomes agree. That's still better than 75%, so this is also ruled out. I can't have this causal structure explaining these. And these are the correlations we actually see in quantum theory. So that's a proof that what we've seen in quantum theory, this trick of winning the game 85% of the time, can't be explained with this sort of causal explanation. So then you might say, all right, well, clearly, we're going to have to go for some other causal explanation, like this one here, right? So this is the explanation where the setting on one side does have a causal influence on the outcome on that. So this is like the cheating strategy, where you signal across the room what the setting was, how the coin came out, so that the other person has the benefit. Now, we've already talked about how this seems to be in tension with relativity theory. So many people think that Einstein's theory of special relativity prohibits causal influences from going faster than light. And this would say, no, a causal influence can reach from one region of space-time all the way across, even when it requires that causal influence to propagate faster than the speed of light. So so for people of that persuasion, they want to say that the only thing that relativity theory really insists on is that you can't send messages faster than the speed of light. So let me just talk a bit about that for a second. So if I wanted to use this to send messages, let me just convince you that you can't use these funny correlations to send any messages faster than the speed of light. So one way you might try to do it is by making the choice of the setting over here on the left determine the statistics for B on the right. So we could have a protocol where we're going to sort of use 100 runs of this experiment, and all of them I'm going to set x is equal to 0 if I want to encode a 0. So the idea is that you're going to have to look at the outcomes in 100 different experiments to decode what I'm sending. So I'll set x equal to 0 for 100 of them if I want to send a 0, but I'll set x equal to 1 for all 100 if I want to send a 1. So if it happens that the probability of B being 0 or 1 is different for those two values of x, like if B is slightly more likely to come out 0 when I've set x equal to 0, then after doing it 100 times, you'll start to see that bias, and you can decode. So that would be a way of sending information if the choice of x could influence the distribution over B, the statistics on B. But it doesn't happen here, and here's why. Suppose I consider the case where y is 0, right? So then we're in the first or the third row. And I just ask, what's the total probability that B is 0? So I have to sum the probabilities that A is 0 and A is 1. So the total probability of B is 0, for instance, in this case, is the sum of this and this, which is exactly 0.5. And the total probability B is 1 is this plus this, and that's 0.5. So the point is here that when x is 0 and y is 0, b equals 0 and b equals 1 are equally likely. But if x is equal to 1 and y is 0, so I've just toggled the value of x, the total value for b is equal to 0 is still a half, and the total value for b is equal to 1 is still a half. So the distribution over the values of b have not changed as I've toggled from x equal to 0 to x equal to 1. So I can't use this to send signals. Okay, so those people who think that relativity just prohibits superluminal signals say, okay, there's nothing wrong with this, right? Because it doesn't allow me to send any signals. But from the perspective of these causal inference algorithms, there's still something to complain about. You might say, well, okay, maybe relativity doesn't prohibit this superluminal causal influence, strictly speaking, but it's still a bad explanation because it's a fine-tuned explanation. So remember, way back in the beginning, we said that if I have an arrow here, I expect these guys to be correlated. But I just explained to you how the B is totally uncorrelated with X. As I toggle X from 0 to 1, B always remains equally likely to be 0 or 1. So there's no correlation between these variables. The only way to ensure that there's no correlation between these variables, even though there's an arrow here, is to make sure that the parameters in the model are fine-tuned to eliminate those correlations. Okay, so roughly speaking, if you have superluminal causes, then the only way that to prohibit somebody from using them to send superluminal signals is to ensure that the theory is fine-tuned, that there's only very specific kinds of conditional probabilities that you can realize in these models. And so these causal inference algorithms say these kinds of explanations are bad explanations. They're not robust to changes in the parameters. So we shouldn't consider this a good explanation of what we've seen. All right, so that rules out this guy. So then you might say, well, what about something like this? This is that second cheating strategy where we have a cause that influenced, it wasn't really a random setting here, it was influenced by something which also influenced the outcome on the other side, for instance. Or maybe it influenced the lambda here. But it's the same thing. This is a bad explanation because it's fine-tuned. Generically, if I have a common cause for two variables like x and b, I expect them to be correlated. But they're not correlated in these experiments. They're completely uncorrelated. The only way for me to get that is to fine-tune these parameters. So it's not a good explanation. And then finally, you can even introduce some examples of causes going backwards in time. Like, what if the setting here reached back in time and changed the strategy of the players somehow? That seems crazy, but even if you grant that craziness, it's still not a good explanation because I've now set up an indirect causal influence of X on B. So generically, I'd expect them to be correlated. The fact that they're not correlated tells me that the only way this model can work is if it's fine-tuned. So it's also considered a bad explanation. So then you can ask, is there anything that can both explain the correlations, but also do it without using fine tuning? And the answer is no. You can go through all the possible explanations, and none of them will give you one that is both capable of reproducing this and avoids fine tuning. And so that's one way to think about the mystery of Bell's theorem and quantum mechanics. Good, so just to summarize, we started with these two principles, that whenever you see these statistical dependencies, they need to be explained causally, and this principle that those causal explanations should not be fine-tuned. And we found that that was in contradiction with what we observed in our quantum experiments. So something has to give. Assuming the experiments that corroborate quantum theory are correct, it looks like we have to give up one of these principles. But they both seem, on the face of it, very good principles. So I would say the first principle is very central to the whole scientific enterprise. That's what we try to do when we see correlations. We try to explain them causally. And the second was is, again, a principle that people use across scientific disciplines to assess whether an explanation is good or not. If your explanation only works when you fine-tune it, it's typically considered a poor explanation. So I kind of want to just leave you with that as basically the main mystery of quantum theory, making sense of Bell's theorem. There are other ways out besides giving up these two. You could start looking for other implicit assumptions in the derivation. But in my view, we still don't have a good resolution of this problem. We still don't have good causal explanations of the correlations we see in quantum experiments. So that means that there's interesting things for young people to do in this field. And with that, let me end. Thanks.
Specifically 85%.
Good. That's a good question. So why is it that quantum mechanics can win these kinds of games with 85% probability, but not a higher probability? So that's actually a subject. So if you ask it sort of why, from the perspective of the existing theory of quantum mechanics, that involves going into the mathematics of quantum mechanics and saying, okay, what kinds of states can I prepare for a pair of particles? What kinds of measurements can I do? And then people have just shown if you do an optimization and you just try to make that probability as high as possible under a variation of your choices of measurements and your system states, and you can really use any degrees of freedom you want and let the dimensions be as large as you like, you get 80, this, it's not quite 85%, but it's in fact 1/2 + 1/2 √2. That is the upper bound that quantum theory predicts. So it just comes out of the formalism of quantum theory. But in quantum foundations these days, a very popular question that's come up is that, can we come up with some principles that might pick out that number? So the idea, a general trend in the field is to say, well, we have this formalism of quantum mechanics, but can we derive it from some ideas about, you know, some physical principles? So in the case of special relativity, famously, Einstein wasn't the first person to write down the Lorentz transformations, the mathematical formulas of special relativity, but he did come up with some physical principles. The speed of light is the same in all reference frames, and it's independent of the source, and he proved that those principles imply the Lorentz transformations. So people try to do the same thing. They try to come up with physical principles that will get you the formalism of quantum theory, and in particular, people would like to find principles that get you this 1/2 + 1/2 √2 performance and not bigger and not lower. So that's relatively new. For a long time, people in quantum foundations sort of focused on why is it not less than 75%? That was the main question, because that's what seemed natural. And only in recent years have they started asking the question, why isn't it more than 85%? But yeah, there are some interesting ideas. So we have some principles that can pick out that, but we don't have any principles that can pick out the quantum performance for all versions of this game. So there's lots of ways I could vary this game by allowing more settings and more outcomes, and we still don't have any principles that can say, here's what dictates the quantum performance.
Are there any explanations in particle physics for this? That is this experiment related to what we know about the elementary particles so far? outside of just quantum theory, like this 85%, is it, under which parameters can it be achieved? With which particles, for example?
So this is very much independent of what type of system you use. So let me put it this way, that we apply quantum mechanics in lots of different domains. So we can apply it to, for example, the position and momentum of some atom. We could apply it to the spin degrees of freedom of a particle. But we also have more exotic properties, like in particle physics, you have isospin of a particle, which relates to whether it's a neutron or a proton, or you could have lots of other internal degrees of freedom. And it really doesn't matter which kind of degree of freedom you're talking about, and whether we're talking about particles at all, or whether we're talking about strings or whatever. Quantum mechanics always says that there's a mathematical formalism, that the states of these objects are determined by a vector in a Hilbert space. And it's a Hilbert space over the complex field. And so there's this common thread to all of it. And the only thing that changes are things like the dimension of the Hilbert space and how I represent certain symmetries. Like if I rotate something, how do I represent that as a transformation on these vectors? That's what changes as I go from system to system. But there's a common core to all of it, which is the mathematical formalism of Hilbert space and how you represent measurements. And that's all I've used here. So these conclusions are independent of the nature of the system that you're using. And so they hold just as much for particle physics experiments or tabletop experiments or experiments involving matter or light or whatever you like.
Can this experiment be conducted with bigger particles?
You said bigger particles or like bigger systems? Yeah, so people have certainly wondered whether you would expect that as you become sufficiently macroscopic, we expect classical physics to be an adequate description for sufficiently macroscopic systems. And so you'd expect that this sort of phenomena ought to go away if you're talking about macroscopic systems. The way people usually argue that's going to occur is not that the macroscopic systems make this impossible in principle, but rather that they make it impossible in practice. Just that to get this experiment to work, I need to prepare the states of those particles very carefully, and I have to isolate them from interactions with their environment, for example. And the bigger of a system I have, the more susceptible it is to interacting with this environment and losing its quantum nature. So this is called decoherence, right? So this pair of particles has to remain coherent, and any interaction with the environment will decohere it and prohibit the performance that we saw and make it come down below 75%. So if I tried to do that with systems that were too complex, then typically interactions with the environment would kill this. But there are some other people who think that even if you manage to isolate things from the environment, that just being macroscopic would somehow make the physics different. That actually quantum mechanics is not true and it breaks down for macroscopic systems. And so some people predict that this sort of experiment will not give you 85% performance for larger systems. So people like that typically endorse what are called collapse theories. So these are modifications of quantum theory that involve systems. You can think of it as decohering, even though they're not interacting with the environment, that they're just going to decohere kind of naturally as a natural process. And the amount of decoherence depends on how big you are. So if you get big enough, you expect not to win this game. But I would say that the standard view is that this will continue to hold for a large system, and it's just a technological problem to do it for bigger systems. Yes.
Well, you said that the 1/2 plus 1/2 comes out of the equations.
Yeah.
But is it possible that we just didn't do the experiment enough times to get the 0.75?
Well, it's certainly true that if you've done an experiment, only a finite number of times, then you have some statistical fluctuations. Like back in the drug trial we were talking about at the beginning, if I only had 10 patients and I got a conclusion, I might say, well, if I had 100 patients, that could reverse. My conclusion could reverse. And usually if I have N patients or trials, then the variability, the fluctuations are on the order of square root of N. So the larger I make N, I can get an estimate of those probabilities with some error term that's like 1 over root N. So if N is 100, then it's 1 over 10, so I get like a 10% error. If N is 10,000, it's a 1% error. So if I can just make the number of trials bigger, I can bring that error down and down and down. And so that's what people do in Bell experiments. They ask, okay, we see this violation. So we don't quite get 85%, because that would require everything to be totally perfect. But we get somewhere close to 85%. And then we ask, how far from 75% is that in terms of these fluctuations? So there's this sort of, it's often called the standard deviation, right? Like I'll have a distribution, and I'll ask about the thickness of that distribution. So what's the chance that it's really 75%, but what I'm seeing is just a statistical fluctuation. It's just a fluke that I'm getting it higher. And so the usual standard in particle physics is a 5 sigma deviation. So that corresponds to a really low likelihood that this is just a fluctuation. In Bell experiments, we have about 5,000 sigma, which means that the probability that this is a fluctuation is astronomically small. So at this point in time, in the very first experiments, that was a viable possibility because we only had a few sigma. But now it's really clear that it's not just a statistical fluctuation.
Are there any examples of phenomena that seems to be faster than light, but it turns out that it does not send information?
Yeah. So there's some nice examples. So shadows can travel faster than the speed of light. If we were at a sports stadium, we could make a wave that travels faster than the speed of light. So if I take the wave in the sports stadium, so does everybody know what that is? Like the wave is like when everybody stands up, like one person stands up and then the person next to them stands up, and it just, when you're looking at it, creates a wave of people standing up. So that's that can be done with a common cause. So if everybody had a watch, right, everyone was instructed, okay, so you're gonna stand up at 10 a.m. The guy next to you, he's instructed to stand up at 10 a.m. plus 1 nanosecond. The guy here stands up at 10 a.m. plus 2 nanoseconds, right? So you can set up a wave with any synchronization you want. You can make it propagate at any velocity. But it's not because this person standing up has caused the person next to them to stand up, but rather it's the common cause of the time that's causing them. So anything that's sort of based on a common cause, I can make it even propagate at infinite velocity by making everyone stand up at the same time, right? That you think of that as a wave that's going infinitely fast. So typically when you find phenomena like shadows and waves that are moving faster than light, it always boils down to, oh, this is not a cause-effect phenomena at all. It's a common cause phenomena. So those are the kinds of things that go faster than light, things that are correlations that are due to a common cause. But we don't know of any cause-effect type influences that propagate faster than light. Bell's theorem is the best candidate for something that implies the need for superluminal causal influences. But as I said, there's a fine-tuning problem. Good. Kelly, do we have one more question in front?
Oh, you have one more question?
We do, yeah.
So yes, we conclude that Bell's theorem contradicts one of the principles of causality. Mm-hmm. Why is it so important to hold on to these principles of causality? What is contradicted if one of them was false?
Well, there are certainly people who think that, for instance, we should give up on this no fine-tuning argument, that maybe quantum mechanics forces us to allow for fine-tuned explanations. That's a possibility, but it is a bit uncomfortable because it just means that your standards for what counts as a good causal explanation will change. In every other scientific discipline, you have certain standards, and then in quantum physics, suddenly you're saying, oh no, quantum physics is different, my standards have to change. So it's not a logical contradiction, but I think it is uncomfortable to be forced to do that. And the first principle, this I feel is just very central to science. There's clearly context in which you wouldn't endorse a rejection of that. So if you went to your doctor and you said, I read this study that showed a correlation between this activity I do and getting this terrible medical condition, do you think that's a causal influence? And the doctor said, oh, I just don't even believe that correlations need to be explained causally. Then you'd be like, oh, I need a new doctor. You know, because it's kind of irrational to not look for causal explanations. So there is room for maybe saying what counts as a good causal explanation ought to be changed in quantum physics. But it's a bit of a challenge to figure out exactly how we should relax those standards.
What if it's an emergent macroscopic effect, the first statement? And that macroscopically, that's not the case. We just can't observe it every day. Is that?
Maybe. Yeah, it's an option.
Ask a small question. Why that particular synchronization? Why that particular combination? I mean, you've been discussing how there's a 75% accuracy of getting that particular combination.
Yeah.
Why is that so specifically important?
Well, if you mean this setup of the game that we played, that was just an example. So there's many versions of that I could give, which would show a gap.
The one that you applied to the particles.
So maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Right, so there was a particular combination that turned out to come true 75% of the time.
Right, this particular game, the third game that we played,
The final one.
Yep.
That was the same thing we were talking about when we were talking about the particles.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that specific combination required? I mean, why is that always the turnout or the outcome?
If you're asking why is it that we see this gap between the quantum performance and the classical performance only in the third game, for example, and not in games two or one?
Yes.
I mean, that really just boils down to the formalism of quantum theory. So quantum theory didn't offer, so first of all, games one and two, we could already win 100% of the time, even in a classical theory involving people. So there was sort of the best you could hope to do is win 100% of the time. So there's no possibility for a quantum advantage. So that tells you have to go looking for other games where because of the structure of the game, you can't win all the time. So the third game was an example of that. But it's not the case that every game I give you where in a classical protocol you couldn't win 100% of the time, it's not necessarily the case that you always get a quantum advantage for that game. So the third game I showed you was specifically tailored to be a very simple example of a game that you can't win all the time classically and for which quantum theory offers an advantage. And there's many other such examples. And then there are games where you can't win it all the time and the quantum performance is exactly the same as the classical performance. And those are just games where quantum mechanics doesn't help you.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you know why some games why quantum mechanics will give some games advantages but not others?
I think it comes down, it's similar to the question about why the 85% performance as opposed to something higher. So we would really need, the formalism of quantum mechanics tells us which games we get an advantage for, but we would really like to have a deeper understanding in terms of some physical principles that both imply the formalism of quantum mechanics and could teach us exactly, maybe give us some intuitions about what sorts of games you'd expect to see a quantum advantage for. So we don't really have that yet.
Okay. There, we go to lunch. First, let's thank Rob again for this.